stand. You can see them. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Were they here for the 1:30?
Nice looking.
The students are here with a program the court sponsors along with the State Bar of Wisconsin. And this is a program called Court with Class. It's a national award-winning program. We invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If they agree to come, we give them material about the case they're about to hear, and they may engage in some activities relating to that case. They come, listen to oral argument, and during the lunch hour, they meet with a Supreme Court a justice to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the cases. Did you all meet with Justice Bradley? Sad. Bad. Well, maybe we can do something either next time or at the end of this oral argument, depending on your schedule for leaving. And so let me say thank you for coming, and let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, the justice with whom you missed the opportunity to meet. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. The chair next to me is at the moment empty. That's usually occupied by Justice Patrick Brooks. He's running a bit late and probably will be in later. He will be, as far as I know, participating in this case. To the left of the empty chair is Justice Patience Rogensack, and to her left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our case 2014 AP 1099 CR, State versus Maltese Lavelle Williams, arguing on behalf of the defendant. Mr. Williams is John A. Prey with the Legal Assistance Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Daniel J. O'Brien. Mr. Prey will have 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. O'Brien will have 30 minutes. We do apologize for running late, but we ran late coming into the lunch hour. Mr. Prey.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is John Prey, and I represent Maltese Williams, who is the defendant in this case. Your Honor, this brief has three issues in it. And I think the Court of Appeals was particularly interested in the first issue, so I intend to mostly spend the time on that. I'm happy to answer questions about the second issue, which is a jury qualification issue, and the other on viewing gory photos in the courtroom. But I plan to spend most of the time on the first issue. As to that first issue, I think in many ways this is a somewhat simple case. Mr. Williams asked for a jury trial, and he had a fundamental constitutional right to that jury trial and to have the facts of that case decided as it applied under the law that was given. Now, the jury was instructed in this case that in order to find Mr. Williams guilty of the felony murder of Mr. Robinson. Now, Mr. Robinson is the guy who's sleeping on the couch in another room, not the target of the original robbery. That's a guy named Parker. The jury was instructed to find Mr. Williams guilty of the felony murder of this sleeping man, Mr. Robinson. He or the co-defendant, that's Mr. Collins, had to attempt to rob him personally. There is absolutely no evidence that anyone tried to rob Mr. Robinson. And I think there's no dispute about that. The jury found him not guilty of that. The Court of Appeals in their certification said we see no evidence of that. And in the state, in their own brief, said we are not pursuing that separate argument because there is little room for it to challenge. That's a quote from page 7 of their brief. So I think that's undisputed that there was no evidence of that. So I think there's no dispute that if the jury instruction is faithfully followed, a finding of felony murder as to Mr. Robinson, the sleeping man, required a finding of an attempted robbery of Mr. Robinson. So the issue here...
Jury instructions accurately represent the statutory law on felony murder?
Yes, absolutely. They represented the statute. Because a perfectly proper way to find guilt of felony murder as to Mr. Robinson is through an attempted robbery of Mr. Robinson. That is one way, one proper way to commit felony murder. So that is consistent with the statute.
That sounds... Did jury instructions leave anything out that might have been applied to the facts of this case?
Did they leave anything out that might have applied?
Yeah, did they leave out a mechanism that would apply to the facts of this case that could still result in felony murder? Did they fail to state?
I can't think of anything that they failed to state. I think that's all they needed to state. I think when
to
you charge...
To be convicted of felony murder, if there were two guys going in, they're going in to rob someone, and one of the co-robbers was killed, could the other robber be convicted of felony murder, even though he never tried to rob his partner?
Under the statute, it is possible, and under case law. That's the Weeman case, and
right.
It is proper under the statute. It would have been a possible way to instruct this jury that if you find that Mr. Williams or his cohort tried to rob Mr. Parker, that's the drug dealer in this case, you could find that the felony murder of both of those were pursuant to that. You could have done that. That could have been a proper instruction. It was not asked for. It wasn't instructed that way. I see that as a choice. I don't know if it's conscious or not, but the prosecutor, when they ask for what jury instructions you want or when they decide what to charge, they decided to charge it as it was. They decided to use armed robbery, for example, as the underlying crime.
Well, it still would be the underlying crime if one of the two defendants were killed during an armed robbery, Counselor. The underlying crime is still armed robbery for felony murder in that case.
That's one of the ways. There's actually 13 different ways to charge. The statute for felony murder has 13 different underlying crimes it could have been. It could have been kidnapping, sexual assault, battery.
I'm talking about the substantive crime of armed robbery. That's not what I'm shifting on in my questioning. So we don't need to go that you could do it with a variety of other substantive crimes that might partner with a murder that occurs when the murder isn't the focus of the folks' activities.
If a colleague, I'll follow up on that question, if a colleague of Williams was shot by the victim before the victim died, you'd need an instruction that would tell the jury that. I mean, you'd have to pattern the instruction at that fact situation that the victim did the killing and that the defendant is still liable.
I think that's right. I think the function of jury instructions isn't to state the entire possible universe of different ways you could have this crime occur, but it's to apply facts as they are in that case to narrow it down somewhat and say, here's the theory we're going under.
It would be bizarre to give them a jury instruction that said, if the victim had shot somebody, the defendant is liable. If the defendant's cohort had shot another cohort, the victim, Williams is liable. You wouldn't be giving those kinds of instructions unless there was something in the fact situation that set that out.
I think that's right, and the case law makes it clear. There's lots of different ways you can have a felony murder.
Problem with this instruction.
I'm sorry?
The problem with this instruction is not that it doesn't state the correct law. It does.
Yes.
The problem with the instruction is that there are other ways of accomplishing being guilty of this crime, which were not in the instruction. Therefore, this reminds me of Wolf, that the instruction is correct, but it's not the only instruction that could have been given. And the facts of the case don't fit the instruction.
That's right. Right? I think it is exactly like Wolf.
So it's like Wolf. But the problem I have is that it smells like Beeman to me at the same time. And in Beeman, the instruction gave a non-crime. That is, the elements given in the Beeman instruction did not define a statutory crime, as I understand it. And the court said, oh, you can't make up a crime and then find the guy guilty of it.
That's correct. They added an element.
But why can't you treat this Wolf instruction as a wrong instruction because it limited it to the robbing of Robinson, armed robbery of Robinson, when it needn't have done that? What I'm driving at is, I'm not sure if you push hard on either Wolf or Beeman, they don't come together and that they're one and the same.
Well, I don't think it's – I don't think the jury instruction needed to give every possible theory it would be. Just like they didn't choose – they didn't say it could also be – based on a kidnapping or sexual assault. They chose one thing, which is attempted armed robbery. Same thing with choosing who the victim is. The victim could be Mr. Robinson. The victim of the armed robbery, attempted armed robbery, could be Mr. Robinson, could also be Mr. Parker, the dealer. And to say that it's adding something to the instruction by saying, by having to say that this could be from an attempted robbery of Mr. Parker or Mr. Robinson, if you get into that game, you're going to have to give huge, massive jury instructions, giving the entire statute, like, here's a possibility. It could have been from kidnapping. It could have been from battery. It could have been from attempting to rob this person or this person or this person. And that's not what jury instructions do. They look at evidence that's there and try to apply it in a more tailored way to what the facts of the case are. So I think the other big difference between Beeman and Wolf is that in Beeman, there was an erroneous jury instruction, and the majority decision said that was adding an element, basically. It was in Beeman, you had to, in Beeman, the jury instruction said you have to find two things, A and B, and say B isn't required. So they said that's a erroneous instruction. To be found guilty of eluding in that case, you have to find both A and B. Can't remember what they are. Eluding and the other one is increasing speed, I believe. You have to find both those. That is adding an element. That is erroneous. That's not required. That was, and in the language of Beeman, that was adding something that the legislature didn't intend. Whereas in this case, it is a proper instruction. There's nothing wrong with the instruction. I imagine that the prosecutor maybe regretted it after or something because they didn't have to go that way, but they did go that way. It's not an error. And if you don't have an erroneous instruction to begin with, it makes no sense to me to say, well, that's harmless error. Because to make something be harmless error, you have to have an error to begin with. And where is the error? I don't see any error.
The error was that the instruction did not fit the facts of the case or the theory.
Well, I would say that was a choice the prosecutor could have made. That, but that die was cast, and it is a proper way to do it the way they did. You can find felony murder of Mr. Robinson by finding he attempted to rob Mr. Robinson. That is not a far-out legal theory.
Mm-hmm.
Why they went that way, I don't know, but they did do it that way. So then the question is, you know, do you have a right to have a jury decide on that element as stated in the jury instructions?
And that was a favorable instruction for the defendant, so you can't hold him to forfeiting or waiving. That's what the state should have objected.
I think so, absolutely. The state claims that we should have objected, and I don't know why any defense attorney would object to that, because it's a proper instruction. So if it's an improper instruction, you could say, officer of the court, you should correct that. But it is a proper instruction, making it harder to convict your client. So I can't imagine why it would be ineffective to fail to object to that. I think what should have happened, if the state wanted to proceed this way, is the prosecutor would say, here's how I want this liability to be done. I want an instruction that will make it clear that in order to find felony murder of Mr. Robinson, you could have robbed either one of them. That's not what it was.
You know, Counselor, as I read 940.03, felony murder statute, it's a very short statute. It's only a paragraph long. And it says, whoever causes the death of another human being while committing or attempting to commit a crime specified in, and it gives the statutes, one of which is armed robbery, which was going on here, may be imprisoned for not more than 15 years in excess of the maximum term of imprisonment provided by law. So it doesn't require that you are convicted of felony murder only when you're trying to rob the person who happens to end up getting killed.
That's right.
It clearly says who causes the death of another. So it can be a co-defendant. It can be someone you weren't trying to rob. A bystander walks around the corner and somehow gets in the way and can be shot. So it seems to me that what is in the jury instruction is really more than is required in the statute. The jury instruction said the focus had to be on the armed robbery of Robinson, correct? And there's a problem because of sparse proof that they were trying to rob Robinson. The state hasn't proceeded on that. Why? I'm not sure, but I'm not always sure why choices are made by counsel, and they're probably not always sure why choices are made up here either. So works both ways. But it seems like the jury instructions had too much in it. They certainly had more than they needed. If they just repeat the words of the statute, there wouldn't have been a problem.
Well, I think the jury instructions should be designed to not just mimic whatever the statute was, but I think they should be designed to say, here's the theory we're going under in this case.
Well, but here it was confusing from what the statute requires, because it didn't require the focus to be on the person who was being robbed. That's not what the statute says.
Not what the statute requires, but it's a proper way to do it.
Well, it's a proper way to do it, maybe, if that's what the facts are, but in this case, clearly, nobody's arguing it was a proper way to do it. Even the defendant is not arguing that it was a proper way to do it in this case, correct?
The defense counsel didn't argue that at – well, actually, in the closing argument, he did make an argument that Mr. Robinson – there's no evidence that Mr. Robinson was robbed. And then he said right after that therefore, you can't find him guilty of any count of murder.
Right, but the prosecutor explained what the statute requires, too, and he didn't use the jury instructions as his explanation. He just explained it as sort of like you and I have been
right.
talking.
Right, and he said many times in that closing argument, don't listen to what I'm saying. Take the law from what the jury instructions say. And, of course, the jury instructions say that, too. Take the law as given in the jury instructions.
Well, if the jurors had, wouldn't be photographic because they'd be doing it with their ears, but the ability to remember everything the judges tell them, I would be a
astounded, and they could probably go on some game show and win a gazillion dollars. So I don't know that they always remember everything, though I'm convinced that they try very hard to follow.
They take jury instructions into the jury room.
They were. I'm 99%. I'm sure they were.
They had them in front of them.
That seems to be the common practice these days more, which is a good thing because you're supposed to be following these complicated instructions, and so I'm almost sure that they were in the room there.
Mr. Prey,
yeah.
The defendant was convicted of two counts of felony murder.
Yes.
If I understand, the remedy you're seeking is not a new trial on this first issue. You want the entire second count of felony murder to be dismissed.
Absolutely. I think that's the only... I don't think there's debate about that. There's debate about whether you should get it with the state, but I don't think there's debate about if someone... If the court finds insufficient evidence on a crime, that works as an acquittal. And so, of course, count one would remain, and whatever this court would do, Mr. Williams still has to face that crime, but count two would be dismissed and acquittal, and it couldn't be retried on that.
Isn't the remedy you seek totally disproportionate to the facts in front of us?
You mean, does it seem like he's getting a windfall or something like that?
Well, windfall would be... Let me give you a hypothetical. All right. Let's say we have two gentlemen over here who run a restaurant in Manitowoc. And a defendant comes in to rob the restaurant in Manitowoc. And there are five people over here sitting. Now, the owner and the person operating the cash register are not killed, but somehow five innocent people who don't own any property there, weren't victims of an attempted robbery, are all killed. But somehow there's that defective jury instruction that said somehow the felony murder, you're going to name these five people, that they have to be intending to steal, to rob from them. Now, you would say that five people can die and there will be no consequence to that except maybe an attempted robbery over here.
I understand the quandary about that, but I think, you know, things like that happen in law all the time. All the time in Fourth Amendment law, we throw out convictions because the constable blundered or the police exceeded their authority and say, well, why is that fair? That's some kind of technicality or something. But here, I think the lesson would be the prosecutor needs to be on his or her toes and understand the law and then decide that this is how I'm going to pursue this and this is how we're going to present it to the jury. And if they presented it to the jury correctly and said that these five young people can be vindicated and that is felony murder, under the statute that's felony murder, but you better have a fair trial that discusses that and allows that theory to proceed. If in that case the jury was told that the only way you can find felony murder of these fine people is to find that you robbed those people, you'd throw up your hands and say the prosecutor chose the wrong theory, and that's the way it goes. It's like the police blundering in a Fourth Amendment thing, but those kind of things happen. So I think prosecutors need to be aware of that.
If the instructions had said, had referred to or rather than and, would there have been the same result?
I think it would take more than that. I understand my opponent here says just that one word. I think it takes more than that. If you break down those instructions, I think you have to take out the count one after each of those things. And I tried to think of, like, well, how would you do it? And I got boggled up. But I do believe it's more than just changing and or. I think you have to take the count one. When you say count one as to Mr. Parker, count two as to Mr. Robinson, it takes more jiggling around, I think, than that.
And now what if the jury was following the instructions that are quoted on the top of page 11 of your brief?
Is that the part where I say if they had ended there, that would have been okay?
Yeah. How do we know that the jury wasn't following those instructions?
Well, those are much more general instructions. The specific instructions, when you get into the actual elements of armed robbery, is what specifies what you do with the armed robbery. These are general instructions. I don't have a problem with those instructions. But then, at least three places after that, it makes clear that it required the robbery, attempted robbery of Mr. Robinson. So, to me, that those are they're okay, but they're too general. And the specific ones after that are the ones that would tell the jury, here's how I'm supposed to apply that. There's one other way to distinguish Beeman and Wolf, and I just want to make a quick note of that. In Beeman, by adding an element, there could be certainty that Mr. Beeman had violated the statute because it said, because the statute required you're guilty of A or B. The instruction said A and B. Well, the jury came up with guilt, so they could be sure that that he had committed A. There's no doubt about that. I think in Wolf, though, there's question about, you know, we can't know. Would he have been found guilty of sexual assault or not? And I think that's applied to our case. I think it's the same thing. You cannot know how this jury would have deliberated and what verdict they would have done. We can speculate, but we can't know what would have happened if they had been instructed that in order to find felony murder against Mr. Robinson, you could have found it through the attempted robbery of the dealer, Mr. Parker. We can't know that. It's different than Beeman, where you can know what they...
Well, here the jury did find felony murder with respect to two different people, but clearly found it with respect to Parker.
They did, and that was not improper. That was evidence that there was a robbery, attempted robbery of Mr. Parker, and he was killed as a result, not by Mr. Williams, but by his cohort. We're not challenging that, but... As to Mr. Robinson, yes, because you have to go by the jury instructions.
Well, you know, the jury instructions are not consistent. And I read you part of them. It says, before you can find defendant guilty of felony murder, the state must prove by evidence which satisfies you beyond a reasonable doubt that the following elements were established: that the defendant attempted to commit the crime of armed robbery as party to the crime, that the death of Michael Parker in count one and Arthur Robinson in count two was caused by the attempt to commit armed robbery, party to the crime. You know, if they followed that and ended up with felony murder, which they did, the jury instructions are consistent with the statute.
If I could finish, I see my red light.
Oh, on. Yes, sure.
But I think it's the answer is the same as I said to Justice Prosser. I think that the instructions we're complaining about are the specific things that go into specifically applying that. These are more, the ones you're citing, I think, I agree, those are proper, but I think they're much more general in scope. So to me, a jury deciding, well, how should we follow these things would look at the more specific application, which was, by the way, stated at least three times.
Well, if they looked at them, they didn't follow them. So maybe they read the first part, like people often do with our opinions, and got tired and didn't read the rest.
Well, I think the more specific ones modify the more general ones. Would
okay,
be
I
answer.
Understand. So.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'll agree with counsel on one thing and one thing only. This could have been a simple case. We wouldn't be here if the judge, instead of in the armed robbery instructions, instead of saying Parker and Robinson, had said Parker and slash or Robinson. And that is clearly what the judge meant when he issued those instructions. How do I know that? Look at the instructions that preceded the felony murder instructions. The instructions on first-degree intentional homicide at document 4911-13 and the instructions on reckless homicide at transcript 4914-16. Both of those instructions use the and or language when referring to Parker and Robinson as potential victims of intentional or reckless homicide. And then the felony murder instruction only uses the word and, but in the general portion of that instruction, that's correct. If the death of Parker and Robinson was caused in the course of an attempted robbery, he's also guilty of felony murder. The problem comes in the specific attempted armed robbery instructions, where we're talking about the victim of the forcibly taking property from the victim, Parker and Robinson, when again, as in the first degree and reckless and first degree intentional, it should have been and slash or Robinson. However, if you were looking in the attempted armed robbery instructions by themselves, as related to verdicts 3 and 4, which were for attempted armed robbery, independent of the felony of the murder charges, those would have also had been correct, because to find him guilty of attempted robbery of Parker in count 3 and attempted robbery of Robinson in count 4, the state had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he took property from the prisoner presence of Parker and Robinson to find him guilty of those two counts. The problem is when these two instructions are pieced together. There isn't a bridging instruction that says before you to find him guilty of felony murder, you do not need to find beyond a reasonable doubt that he intended to also kill Robinson.
Well, the trial judge tried to instruct him on that. They said if you find felony murder, do not answer the questions on attempted armed robbery. Didn't the trial judge instruct them that if you find felony murder, you are not to answer the
questions? That's correct, and they didn't follow that. They found him not guilty of Robinson's felony murder, which was immediately, obviously that was that in itself was a harmless error because in essence it worked as an acquittal of attempted armed robbery.
They found him guilty, didn't they?
No,
guilty.
They found him guilty of Parker's robbery, not guilty of Robinson's robbery. That's why the state was in a difficult position in arguing that there was evidence to support the attempted armed robbery of Robinson when the jury said that there wasn't.
Counsel, can we be clear on something? He was found guilty of felony murder for the two individuals, but armed robbery of Parker and not Robinson. You said it differently just now. I want to make sure that you and I understand the facts the same way, because I'm going through it right now.
Okay, could you repeat the question?
I'm just trying to clear. You said something that I think is incorrect, and before we go down that path, I want to make sure you and I are on the same page. He was convicted of felony murder of the two people, right?
Correct.
Two separate counts.
Correct.
Convicted of armed robbery with respect to
Parker only,
but not with respect to Robinson.
Correct.
You had earlier said he was found not guilty of felony murder. That's why I'm stopping you.
Okay, I'm sorry if I said that. Yeah, I meant not guilty of the attempted robbery of Robinson. Right. That's correct.
That's what makes the felony murder one of Robinson so difficult for you.
Yeah, but that verdict is correct as far as the actual felony murder law requires.
In fact, the state moved to dismiss, and it was dismissed, the robbery, right?
The robbery as with respect to Parker was dismissed because of the law that does not allow you to convict of both.
Why would they do that?
Well, because case law requires it.
Why?
The State v. Gordon decision that you go back to, what is it, Carlson? that you can't convict both a felony murder and the underlying felony.
That's why
the judge instructed them not to reach those issues, although that got a little confusing because if you look at the very end of the instructions, the judge instructed the jury that you must return a verdict on each count and consider each count separately from the others. So that's a little confusing in and of itself. I mean, defense counsel opened the instruction conference here with the comment that I think is quite apt, that because of the number of charges, this case presented a legal Rubik's Cube that even a learned hand would have difficulty untangling. And we're asking a jury to do that. But the fact is, it cannot reasonably be argued that this is anything other than an erroneous instruction when it comes to felony murder liability. If you agree with how a defense counsel reads this instruction, it's in essence directing the jury not to find him guilty of felony murder of Robinson unless it also finds beyond a reasonable doubt that the murder was committed in the course of attempting to rob Robinson, and it matters not that the murder was committed in the course of attempting to rob Parker. That is a blatant misstatement of the law, and that is not what anyone intended to go before the jury at trial. The defense theory at trial was not that the state failed to prove he robbed Robinson, therefore it failed to prove felony murder of Robinson. The defense theory was that Williams was guilty of no crime whatsoever because when he went there with the other two, he had no idea that they were going to rob Parker. And he was just there to help facilitate a marijuana buy. That's the only reason why he was there. If the jury believed that, he was guilty of no crime. There was no separate argument that, oh, by the way, he's also not guilty of felony murder because the state didn't prove that he robbed Robinson. That argument was never made, and the prosecutor, both in his initial closing argument and in his rebuttal argument, made it quite clear what the correct understanding of felony murder law. I point to pages 45 and 65 on document 49 of the closing arguments of the prosecutor, where he correctly states what felony murder law is, and there's no objection by defense counsel. So the jury went to their deliberations with that correct understanding of the law. Now, counsel might say, well, you know, we're governed by the instructions, not the arguments. Well, to an extent, that's true. But going back to this court's decision in Zelenka in 1986 and going through cases such as Nieder v. United States, Harvey, and ending, well, State v. Smith in 2012 and ending with Beeman, we do not consider the instructions in artificial isolation. We consider all of the instructions that were given, and we consider how the case was argued, how the evidence was presented, how the case was presented to the jury. To be honest with you, felony murder here was more or less an afterthought. This case was a first-degree intentional homicide case. The focus was on whether he committed murder intentionally, he or his cohorts, or committed murder intentionally or recklessly. That was the focus of this trial. Felony murder was added as a lesser-included offense instruction, and the only one who really spent a lot of time addressing it was the prosecutor in closing argument. Counsel argues, well, blame the prosecutor for this. Well, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around. The judge could have caught it. The prosecutor could have caught it. Defense attorney should have caught it because he let his client be convicted of two counts of felony murder even though he knew there wasn't evidence to support it. He didn't move. He didn't ask the judge not to give a felony murder instruction because there's no evidence. He didn't move for a directed verdict even after the jury found him guilty of felony murder on the ground that there was no evidence. It seems to me his responsibility here was...
There was no evidence of what, Brian?
Pardon me?
There's no evidence of what?
Well, he's arguing that there was no evidence to support the felony murder of Robinson. And yet he let that case go to the jury even though he now claims that there was no evidence to support.
Mr. O'Brien, there was evidence to support felony murder of Robinson because the felony was against Parker.
Correct.
And that was good enough, I think, under the law, for Williams to be guilty of felony murder of Robinson, right?
I agree.
All right. So there was evidence and there was a crime, felony murder on Robinson. The problem is that the jury instruction said it's felony murder if you were attempting or carrying out a felony against Robinson. That's true, too, right? It may not tell the whole story, but it is true, right?
It's true, but it's not how the case was argued.
I know, but that's a good instruction.
Well, no, it's not good, because it's essentially telling the jury that, conversely, they can't find him guilty if they only find that there was an attempted robbery of Parker.
Well, that's
the argument that's being presented here. They couldn't find him guilty.
That's the problem. So, now this came up to us on certification. And the Court of Appeals threw up its hands on the case, saying, hey, we can't tell if it's Beeman or Wolf. If it's Beeman, it's not a crime known. And you test the evidence. You don't test the evidence against the instructions, right?
If it's Beeman?
Is it Beeman or Wolf? Is this case a Beeman or Wolf case, or can't you answer it?
It's clearly erroneous instructions.
Now, why is it a Beeman case?
Because it's basically telling the jury they can't find him guilty unless they find him guilty of attempting to rob Robinson, which is not 940.03. And therefore, it's an erroneous instruction case. It's very much like the Zelenka case, where you had the party to a crime instruction that erroneously instructed on direct commission when all the evidence and all the argument focused on aiding and abetting because there was no dispute that someone else directly committed the crime. That's an erroneous instruction. Therefore, we go to harmless error. And every case since then, except Wolf, has considered the question of harmless error. And that makes Wolf, in my mind, an outlier. But even if you think there's a distinction, I think the distinction is that Wolf was correct. That instruction was correct because it presented one legal theory, a statutory. There were separate statutory crimes there. Sexual assault by intrusion into the anal or genital opening, which was the crime set forth in the instructions, but there's a separate crime under the sexual assault section, sexual assault by fellatio. That's not a factual theory. Those are legal crimes, and it had both occurred in that case, he could have been charged with two separate crimes. The problem for the state and Wolf is that they only produced evidence of fellatio and did not produce evidence of the legal theory, the crime, the statutory offense that they had alleged in the instructions. Where here, the crime is the same. It's felony murder of Robinson during the course of an attempted armed robbery. There's no different statutory section at play here. It's the same statute. The instruction erroneously narrowed the scope of that statute. And so what you ended up here with the jury being arguably, if you agree with his interpretation, and I really don't. I actually think these instructions can be read globally in conjunction with how the case was presented as allowing for the jury to do exactly what it ended up doing here, find him not guilty of attempted robbery of Robinson, but guilty of his felony murder. But if you agree that they say that they are as restrictive as he says they are, then they're erroneous. And we follow the Zelenka, Nieder v. United States, Harvey, Smith, and Beeman line of authority, and we apply the harmless error doctrine here, and it's clear beyond any reasonable doubt that a properly instructed jury, and it's jury that heard or Parker and Robinson, would have found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of felony murder of Robinson in the course of the attempted robbery of Parker. So it is as simple as that. It's as simple as and or. And it is as simple as saying this is an erroneous instruction, just like the instructions were erroneous in Zelenka, Smith, Harvey, et cetera. And you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You don't tell the victims of those five people killed in the hypothetical restaurant in Manitowoc, tough luck. The prosecutor didn't do his job, and the defense attorney wanted to build error into the record and sandbag everybody. That's not the way we do justice in the state. A defense attorney is an officer of the court, just as a prosecutor is, and it is his job, if he sees errors, to bring it to the court's attention, and I see it in transcripts all the time. You don't, and it's very questionable strategy if he doesn't do that, to allow a verdict to go to a jury when he knows that there's no, in his mind, there's no evidence to support it based on the theory that he believes the instructions are presenting, and risks a conviction and a murder sentence. That's strategy under Strickland, but boy, that's shaky strategy indeed.
It sounds like the felony murder was a good idea because the jury may not have convicted of the two higher crimes, right?
Well, I think my speculation here is what happened here is what often happens when felony murder goes to the jury. One of two things. Either one, they just get hopelessly confused and fall back on it, or two, it's a compromise verdict. Because I think there was quite powerful evidence here of at least reckless homicide as party to the crime especially. But, yeah, I think Williams did quite well with this
intentional
verdict.
Intentional and reckless as to each victim. And then if they didn't reach a conclusion on intentional, they went to reckless. If they didn't reach a conclusion on reckless, then they went to felony murder. I'm reading the instructions
right now.
How it works. So
yeah, they went down from one to the one. And so, you know, for whatever reason, they found him not guilty of both of the higher offenses, and that's certainly their prerogative. And maybe there was something that they had trouble factually with that failed to convince them beyond a reasonable doubt. And they thought that felony, and certainly the facts fit felony murder. There's no question about that as far as a murder committed in the course of a felony. Far more than even the Oyman and Rivera situations. Here we have a victim of someone who was right there with the intended victim being shot. That's classic felony murder.
Do you know what happened to Mr. Collins?
My understanding is, and I'm going on what the prosecutor told me, is that Collins pled guilty to two counts of felony murder. But I also understand that the other man, Williams, was convicted after a jury trial of two counts of reckless homicide and two counts of actual armed robbery in this case, not even attempted robbery. So I don't know more than that. I don't know if the state found more facts in the interim or what, you know.
The actual shooter just had felony murder?
The shooter was Collins, and he ended up, that's my understanding. Now, that's all I know. And so I can't elaborate on why that might be, but it was a guilty plea, whereas the other man went to trial, as did Williams, and I guess rolled the dice. I'm not quoting any court records. I'm going on basically what the prosecutor told me that was involved in all of these cases. So that's subject to correction if I'm wrong on that. This would be closer to a Wolf situation where if the instructions, like the sexual assault statute in Wolf, the felony murder statute here lists various felonies, predicate felonies, that the state must prove that the murder was in the course of committing. Armed robbery or attempted or an attempt at armed robbery is one. Burglary or armed burglary or an attempt is another. Sexual assault or attempted sexual assault is another. Now, in this case, if the instruction was not on attempted armed robbery but armed burglary or attempted sexual assault, and the facts came out as it was, where these men were invited into the house, they did not burglarize it, there was no attempted sexual assault, and they, as the evidence showed, attempted to rob Parker, and then these people died. Well, then we have a Wolf situation, because we have a correct crime charged, felony murder in the course of committing armed burglary, or felony murder in the course of committing armed robbery, But and that's the legal theory of liability the state chose to charge, and that's the theory the state chose to present. Nobody overlooks something like that. And yet the only evidence that comes out is the attempted robbery, and there's no evidence of burglary, such as the Wolf situation. Now you have an instruction that's legally correct. You have facts. You have a crime proven at trial, but it doesn't fit the instruction. It doesn't fit the legal crime charge. It's a separate crime, and so, like in Wolf, you basically charge the wrong crime. Where here, the instruction basically diminished the crime of felony murder by restricting its scope, and that it can't do. That's a violation of 940.03. Sure, theoretically, in a given case, let's say there's only Robinson there. Of course, you're going to instruct if you find that they attempted to rob Robinson and that his death was caused in the course of attempting to rob him, he's guilty because there's no one else there. And again, that gets back to the proper language would have been the use of and or rather than just and. So I think that's one way to distinguish Wolf. But again, so you can make the argument those were legally correct instructions, whereas here, this was not it was not legally or factually correct. It unnecessarily narrowed 940.03 scope, and it didn't fit the facts as presented at trial and as argued at trial. And it didn't hurt the theory of defense because the defense theory was that he didn't do anything. He was just there to help facilitate a drug deal, and his buddies decided on their own to commit an armed robbery and to shoot people. So, again, if ever there was a case for harmless error, I think this is it. If we're going to follow the line of cases beginning with Zelenka through Beeman, that a rational jury properly instructed here on felony murder law would have found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of the murder of Robinson in the course of committing the attempted armed robbery of Parker, because it happened right on the heels of Parker's shooting as they ran past Robinson out the door and as Robinson resisted.
How would you write this opinion? Where would you start?
Well,
another way of asking the question is, would you write it the way the Court of Appeals did?
Something to the effect of, as this court held in Beeman v. State, an erroneous jury instruction is subject to the harmless error rule of Nieder v. United States and State v. Harvey. And this instruction was erroneous because it erroneously limited the scope of felony murder liability under 940.03. However, a rational, properly instructed jury would have found Williams guilty of felony murder as party to the crime because in light of the facts that Robinson's death was in fact caused in the course of the attempted armed robbery of Mr. Parker.
And
that's how you'd start. And then you would go on and explain. And I guess the big question would be to distinguish Beeman from Wolf. But I think one easy way is to just say, well, we didn't consider harmless error in Wolf. We're considering it here, as we have in all of these other cases, such as Zelenka, Harvey, Smith, et cetera, and Beeman. Or you could make that distinction of Wolf charging a separate type of sexual assault, a separate statutory recognized crime that didn't fit the facts of the case, and maybe use the example here of had this been a charge of armed burglary and the evidence showed armed robbery, we might be in a Wolf situation. But here, this is something entirely different. This is something that was an error, a misapplication of, or a misdescription, I think one of the U.S. Supreme Court cases, California v. Roy, talks, misdescription of the elements of 940.03 that unnecessarily restricted the statute, and it was overlooked by everyone, and we go to harmless error analysis. I think that's the only way I guess that's the way I would start out the opinion.
So are we going to be able to clean up the difference between demon and wolf? I mean, that's what the Court of Appeals was complaining about in its certification. Or maybe you think they're wrong, that there's a clear difference and they just didn't see it.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess the question is whether those instructions in Wolf were erroneous or just were correct as far as the law goes. I guess the way that Wolf meshes with Beeman is to state that those instructions chose one form of criminal liability under the sexual assault statute, just as when the state charged him with attempted armed robbery, it shows one form of criminal liability under the felony murder statute here. And then if you choose the wrong form of criminal liability, which is, after all, a separate crime, felony murder with intent to commit armed burglary, felony murder with intent to commit sexual assault, or in Wolf, sexual intercourse by fellatio, as opposed to the other charge, then you're bound to the crime that you charged. And that... to me, is one way to distinguish Wolf, I think, and that's what. And then you're into the sufficiency of evidence. Did the state prove the crime? Well, not so much charged, but the crime presented, the legal theory of liability presented to the jury. Did the state prove that beyond a reasonable doubt? In Wolf, it didn't. And had this been armed burglary here or sexual assault as the predicate felony, the evidence would have been insufficient here as well. The fact is, the evidence was sufficient to convict him of the charged offense, which was felony murder. And there's no separate subsection in the felony murder statute limiting liability to the murder of the intended victim of the underlying felony. That's one way of doing it, but it's not it's not limited to that.
Are there, if the court were to decide in your favor, are there any United States Supreme Court decisions that we have to wrestle with?
Not that I'm aware. I mean, I think Nieder v. United States allows this, and I think this court correctly followed Nieder and Harvey and Beeman and Smith, that Nieder says. Nieder was a case where the court improperly directed a verdict on the materiality element of the fraud statute, but there was really no dispute that there was the guy didn't disclose $5 million in revenue, which is a material failure to disclose, and the court said a rational jury would have found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt absent the error, and I think so. I don't think you have to wrestle with that one. I think that helps it. Now, I don't know if there's something on your mind that you're thinking of a case that does create problems, but if there were cases before Nieder, I don't think there are any cases after Nieder. I think Nieder goes hand in hand with what this court has done. And, in fact, I think the Zelenka case was 13 years before Nieder, and this court was quite prescient in its unanimous opinion in Zelenka in dealing with the erroneous instruction there and applying the harmless error rule. And that thread is consistent throughout up to the Beeman case here. So unless there are any more questions, I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the state's argument really boils down to the requirement that this be an erroneous instruction. It simply is not an erroneous instruction. Let me go to the hypothetical I used in my brief. There's many ways you can commit battery, but let's just say you could kick somebody or you could hit somebody. And let's say all I did is I kicked Mr. O'Brien. That's all I did. And then I get a jury instruction, and I'm charged with battery, and I go to trial, and I get a jury instruction that says you can find him guilty if you hit him. And I would come after being convicted, and I'd say there is no evidence I hit him. I kicked him. And I think what Mr. O'Brien and the state would argue here is that was an erroneous instruction, even though it's correctly stated a way you can commit a battery, but I think the state would say it's limited battery to, now I forget which one I said, kicking or hitting. It artificially limited that by saying the only way you can do battery is by hitting. That's not true. You can hit, you can kick. It doesn't make it erroneous instruction. And I think that's the same thing here. If it's not an erroneous instruction, I think the whole house of cards falls. You can't have something harmless error without it being an error. And I think, you know, what's being forgotten here is the fundamental right to a jury trial. I understand there's victims' rights. There's all kinds of things that happen on to victims and things that shouldn't happen. But we're talking about a very fundamental right to be convicted by a jury on what was asked by the jury to decide. And if it wasn't an error, it can't be harmless. And so that's, I think in Wolf, that wasn't an error, and that didn't artificially somehow tell the jury that you're limiting the liability. It was simply they chose the wrong thing. That's what happened here. The prosecutor chose the wrong theory, but they chose it nevertheless. They went with it. And, you know, to decide otherwise, if harmless error applies to anything, you could just come in and say, we don't even need a jury verdict anymore. We can just look and see there's plenty of evidence that this guy did it. We got a confession. We got eyewitness identification. We have DNA evidence. We have all this evidence. And anything that was in that jury instruction must be harmless. And that can't be, because it's a fundamental precept of our criminal justice system that you have a right to 12 jurors deciding that, and they're told to go by the instructions that are given. They were correct instructions, and I think that's what we have to do, whatever the consequences of that are.
Did the prosecutor draft the instructions?
I am afraid I don't know the exact answer. I think it was kind of a committee thing. I think they both presented instructions, and then the judge made a decision, here's how we're going to go. There wasn't a lot of discussion about that, certainly about the issue in this case, but I honestly don't know which one is responsible for coming up with this exact wording.
When you say the prosecutor is responsible for the wrong theory, aren't you attributing to the prosecutor the whole idea of going forward on felony murder, as opposed to actually submitting these are the instructions to implement the charge?
Well, I think both. I mean, the prosecutor could have submitted instructions that fit the crime better. I think the prosecutor in this case thought we could get felony attempted armed robbery against Mr. Robinson. That's why they presented that as count four. They thought we could convict on count four here, attempted armed robbery, and therefore, if you get count four on that, you can also get felony murder. That would have been an okay way to do it. The problem was there was zero evidence of a robbery of Mr. Robinson. And, you know, maybe the prosecutor should have or could have charged it not as attempted armed robbery, but attempted burglary or something else, or just forgotten it. Well, just different ways to do it, but that was the choice that was made.
So how would you write it?
I would write it that in order to have harmless error, there must be an error. And this is not an error because it correctly stated the statute. It wasn't telling the jury the only possible way you could ever prosecute for felony murder was through the armed robbery of Mr. Robinson. That's the way a statute would have allowed it, but in this case, the jury instructions have to be followed. So I would say the difference between Beeman and Wolf and what should be written in this case is, in order to apply harmless error, you have to have an error. It's a very fundamental thing, and I think it's as simple as that. My light is on. So
no sufficient.
Thank you very
not
much.
Not sufficient evidence. Therefore, you have to.
Not sufficient evidence.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both Mr. Ray and Mr. O'Brien for their arguments today on review of Beeman and Wolf and harmless error. And the court will take this case under advisement. So ends our hearing on 2014 AP 1099 CR, State versus Maltese Revelle Williams. The court is will meet in the conference room at about 3:20, and the court is. In recess until tomorrow morning when at 9:45 we'll hear another case, and we have three cases on the calendar for tomorrow. We are in recess.